Welcome to Daily Wisdom, Walking the Path with the Buddha, a podcast shared by David Roylance. This podcast is dedicated to guiding you to completely eliminate the discontent mind and the suffering it causes by attaining enlightenment. Learn and practice the teachings of Gautama Buddha that will guide you to fully attain a peaceful, calm, serene, and content mind with joy. To support this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha or visit buddhadailywisdom.com, where you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online learning resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Now, here's our teacher to share more.
Sawadee krap. Hello and welcome to Daily Wisdom, Walking the Path with the Buddha. Today is our group learning program, and I'm going to be sharing with you chapter 24 from this particular book, Developing a Life Practice, The Path That Leads to Enlightenment. This chapter is titled Misunderstandings of Gautama Buddha's Teachings. This is where I help you to understand some of the common misunderstandings of Gautama Buddha's teachings, which will actually help you to clarify your understanding of what the teachings of the Buddha are in the path to enlightenment and how to actually attain enlightenment. So far in this program, over the course of 7 months, essentially 6.5 months, I've been sharing with you how to actually get to enlightenment based on the original teachings of the Buddha, sharing with you all the various aspects of his teachings, helping you to understand not only the meditation, but all the other teachings that you need in order to make your way to this enlightened mental state where the mind can be peaceful, calm, serene, and content with joy, eliminating all the discontent feelings so that you're no longer experiencing any anger, sadness, frustration, irritation, annoyance, guilt, shame, fear, boredom, loneliness, shyness, resentment, jealousy. All these difficult and discontent feelings are plaguing the mind and allowing the mind to be shaken up so that now it's very difficult to make wise decisions that are going to lead to wholesome results. So here at the end of the book and at the end of this program, I'm helping students to further understand the teachings of the Buddha by pointing out some of the common misunderstandings that you'll see in the world. So I'm going to be sharing with you this today as we go through our class, and you're welcome to ask any and all questions as we go. You can put those into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, and I'll be able to see those in the comments section, or you can raise your hand electronically and ask any questions that you like. In order to get started in sharing with you the common misunderstandings about the teachings of the Buddha, I would like to first help you understand the history of the various traditions that have spawned since the lifetime of the Buddha. This will actually help you to understand why there's misunderstandings in the world. During the lifetime of the Buddha, he shared teachings that lead to enlightenment. He was able to teach what it took for him to get to enlightenment, so then by sharing that with others, others could learn, they could reflect, independently verify, and they could practice in order to uproot pollutions in the mind. It takes a certain amount of wisdom that you accumulate through not believing the teachings of the Buddha and hoping something good happens when you die, but instead, you're learning teachings now, you're reflecting on those to independently verify them, and you're practicing them in order to transform the mind and uproot the 10 individual pollutions that he found in the mind. These are called the 10 fetters, or the taints, or the pollutions or defilements. The reason why they're called fetters is during ancient times, an individual would have a shackle and a chain and a ball around their ankle, and this is what would keep a prisoner trapped in a certain area. Rather than putting them in a jail cell, they would put this fetter on their leg. Well, these 10 fetters that the Buddha discovered are the 10 pollutions that are keeping the mind trapped in this continuous cycle of experiencing anger and sadness and frustration and all these other discontent feelings. So it's only when you acquire wisdom that will help you to eradicate these pollutions and these taints or these defilements, these fetters, and that's where the brightness and the radiance of the enlightened mind shines through. And not only do you eliminate those discontent feelings and experiencing the peace and joy for the rest of this life, but you notice the concentration and the focus, the clarity, the deep memory comes into the mind. You'll notice that your personal professional relationships really blossom because you're not being harsh and bitter and hostile in your relationships anymore. You won't even be in a bad mood anymore. You'll always be in a good mood because the causes and conditions that are causing the bad mood to occur have been eradicated from the mind. So this is what the Buddha taught during his life, but then from his life, things oftentimes change, right? Because of the universal truth of impermanence that you learn throughout this program with me, things are constantly changing. So while the natural laws that the Buddha taught are the same natural laws during his lifetime as they are now, the books, the memories, what people understood about his teachings from 2,500 years ago, all started to gradually change over time. And the Buddha predicted that this would actually occur. And he gave guidance on how to ensure that his teachings remained in place so that countless people could get to enlightenment after his death. So today, what we have is we have three main traditions of what's considered to be Buddhist. And then we have various branches of these as well. There's probably 200 or 300 different branches of Buddhist teachings. The Theravada tradition, which is primarily hosted in South Asia and Southeast Asia, which are countries like Myanmar, Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, Southern Vietnam, Sri Lanka, places like this are really hosting these teachings and practicing them. But really, they've been spread all throughout the world. This word Theravada means teachings of the elders. And in this tradition, they look to the Pali Canon, which is the original source teachings of the Buddha, which was documented not too long after his death. They consider this to be his original teachings, and they're not interested in changing his teachings. And that's why it's referred to the teachings of the elders, because it's considered to be the form of Buddhist teachings that's closest to what existed during the lifetime of the Buddha. Then there's a tradition that spawned about 500 to 1,000 years later called Mahayana Buddhism. This is primarily hosted in places like East Asia, which is China. Here you see some modifications to what the Buddha taught, where you start seeing certain rites and rituals and ceremonies and worship coming into play. Certain prayers and things like this that the Buddha didn't actually teach. And then about 1,000 years after the death of the Buddha, you get Vajrayana Buddhism, which is primarily hosted in Tibet, Bhutan, Mongolia, and the Russian Republic of Kalmykia. This is the tradition that you'll see the Dalai Lama practicing. And here, there's a lot of divergence from the teachings of the Buddha, where you see this worshiping of deities, you see many rites, rituals, ceremonies, you see various prayers and things like this. And some people refer to these as the lesser vehicle, or Hinayana for Theravada Buddhism, or they refer to Mahayana Buddhism as the greater vehicle, or Vajrayana Buddhism as the lightning fast vehicle. And what people are alluding to when they share that is they're essentially sharing that in order to get to enlightenment, it takes you a lot longer through the Theravada tradition versus the Mahayana versus the Vajrayana. But anybody who's trying to hurry up and get to enlightenment, they haven't really understood how to actually get to enlightenment, because you can't hurry up and get to enlightenment. That would be craving, desire, attachment. And as long as there's rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship in a practice that is being attributed to the Buddha, this isn't actually going to lead to enlightenment, because the ultimate goal is to get to wisdom. The way you get to wisdom is you learn something, you investigate it, you examine it, you don't believe it. With belief, you don't know what's true or false, so you can't believe your way to enlightenment. You can't do rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship in order to get to enlightenment. It's not like enlightenment is bestowed upon you by doing rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship. Your mind is gradually trained in order to cultivate this wisdom through learning, investigating, examining, through reflecting to independently verify whether the teachings are true, which I've shown you how to do that as part of the teachings that I've been sharing over the last several months. And then I've taught you how to practice the teachings, how to move them into your life and integrate them into your life so that you can uproot these pollutions out of the mind. This is what actually produces the enlightened mind, because you're eliminating the pollutions. But in these other traditions, you'll oftentimes see a lot of rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship. You even see that in the Theravada tradition too. So many of the things that I'm going to talk with you about today related to misunderstandings of Gautama Buddha's teachings are actually based in the Theravada tradition, because as you've learned from me throughout this program, is that the Buddha didn't teach rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship. But if you go to a Buddhist temple today, one of the very first things that you might actually see are rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship. And you might say, hey, what happened? Like, David taught me there is no rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship in the teachings of the Buddha. But here I am visiting a Buddhist temple, and there's rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship. Well, as part of all the temples and all the different Buddhist places and community centers around the world that are sharing what they consider to be Buddhist, I've been to about 200 of them, and of course there's tens of thousands of them all throughout the world, but I've visited over 200 of them. And out of those 200 that I visited, over 200, I've only ever visited one that shares the original teachings of the Buddha based in the Pali Canon, which is his original teachings. You might think that every Buddhist monk must know the teachings of the Buddha, or every Buddhist temple must be sharing the teachings of the Buddha based on his original words. But that would be permanence. And we understand the universal truth of impermanence, and not every temple is going to be sharing the original teachings. The teachings of the Buddha aren't organized in terms of there's one person at the top and then they're disseminating teachings and everybody needs to follow those teachings, like rules or commandments. This would be like an organized religion where maybe somebody's gathered up, or an organization has gathered up teachings. They put one person at the top and then everyone is being told what to do by that person or that leader. That's not what the teachings of the Buddha are. Each individual temple is essentially operating independently of each other and sharing the teachings from that master teacher at that particular temple. So not all the temples in the world are sharing the original teachings of the Buddha. And if you do the math that I've visited over 200 temples and only one is actually sharing the original teachings of the Buddha, this is less than 1%. So the teachings of the Buddha are at this low point in society. And the Buddha described that this is actually what was going to occur at this point in time in history, that we would reach this low point. And we can see in the world that there's all kinds of calamity everywhere, all throughout the world. As the teachings of the Buddha come into the world more and more, and people understand what the true teachings are, this is where we'll see more and more people getting to enlightenment and more peace existing in the world. But each individual needs to choose to do that on their own and be able to see the clarity of the teachings, practice them, and then experience the actual results. So these are the three main forms of Buddhism that you'll see. And people refer to these as Buddhism, but if you understand that there was only one Buddha, there can only be one set of teachings that is actually from the Buddha. All these things can't actually be Buddhist. And with 200 to 300 different branches of what people are referring to as Buddhist, these all can't be what the Buddha actually taught. So by you going back to the original source teachings, which is the way that I share, and then not believing those teachings and not believing me, you can cut through this impermanence and being able to see what is true and what is false through you learning, examining, investigating, through you reflecting, and through you practicing. Because keep in mind, the Buddha didn't share the way the world should be, and then if everybody follows a certain set of rules or commandments, that then the world will become peaceful. Instead, what he did is he explained the way the world is. And by understanding the way the world is, your mind awakens to this wisdom of the natural laws. And then this is where you can navigate the world more peacefully. Because when you exist in a world that you don't understand, you'll struggle and you'll have difficulties. That anger and sadness and frustration and all those other discontent feelings, those are the indication to you that you haven't yet cultivated the wisdom that you need to fully eradicate these feelings. The mind is still struggling in the world. There are certain things that you don't know yet. You're lacking certain wisdom. So it's when you cultivate wisdom and acquire wisdom that you can now navigate the world more readily. And this is the same thing you did with the natural law of gravity, that at one time in your life, you didn't understand the natural law of gravity. None of us did. And when we grew up, we really struggled and had difficulties navigating the world. We fell down, we hit our head, we bumped our elbow, we maybe broke open our knee and started bleeding. We broke our toys. We had all kinds of trouble with this natural law because this natural law of gravity affected us whether we were aware of it or not. And when we lacked wisdom, we made unwise decisions that led to unwholesome results. But slowly but surely, we awoke to this wisdom of the natural law of gravity. We saw the truth for ourselves, and we started making wiser decisions naturally. By the time we got to age 10 or 12 or 14, we were tying our shoes a bit tighter. We were looking at the surface of the sidewalk, making sure that we're not so giddy and bouncing and excited as we walk through the world. We started making wiser decisions to be able to ride a bicycle, to climb a ladder, to get on airplanes, because we fully understood this natural law of gravity and we no longer struggled with it. We could make wise decisions that led to wholesome results. And the natural laws of existence that the Buddha taught are the same way, that they're affecting us whether we're aware of them or not. And when you lack wisdom, you're going to naturally make unwise decisions that lead to unwholesome results. But when you can train your mind through learning reflecting and practicing acquiring wisdom of these natural laws, namely the natural law of gamma, of cause and effect, then you can understand the wisdom of these natural laws, and now you'll make wiser decisions that produce this wholesome results in your life. And one of those wholesome results is that you can eliminate discontentedness by getting to the enlightened mental state. So it's the Theravada tradition that is considered to be the tradition that's closest to the lifetime of the Buddha, but in reality, even in this tradition, there's things that are being practiced that aren't actually the teachings of the Buddha, because various people are doing different things, and because of the teachings of the Buddha primarily happening through the oral tradition from the lifetime of the Buddha until now, in an oral tradition, it's very easy for things to inadvertently be changed, or in some cases, overtly being changed. Because the Buddha spoke whatever he spoke 45 or 2,500 years ago over the 45-year period that he was alive in teaching the teachings that he shared. During that 45-year period from the age of 35 to 80, he shared what it took for him to get to enlightenment and then invited other people to be able to experience that same enlightened mental state. But it's been 2,500 years since he taught. And now, having the teachings handed down orally, even though they are in written format, then people either inadvertently changed his teachings or overtly changed his teachings. Because printing out a complete source collection of the original teachings of the Buddha is very costly. There's 45 large volumes of books that are about 10 centimeters thick or 4 or 5 inches thick. And here in Thailand, if somebody were to acquire a set of those books, it would be about 3 months of their salary to be able to acquire those. And the average person doesn't own any book collection, whether here in Thailand or anywhere in the world, that is valued at 3 months of their salary. So the average Thai person, the average person in the world, doesn't have a complete collection of the original teachings of the Buddha. Even the average temple doesn't have a complete collection of the original teachings of the Buddha. So this oral tradition has been in place for so long that people have gotten really far away from his teachings. And what I'm looking to do in the rest of my life is to bring these teachings to the world in such a way that it doesn't require you to pay money to be able to acquire the teachings of the Buddha. And this is why I give the books away for free. This is why you can download them, go print them. And even if you get printed versions, they're a consolidated version so that you're not having to print out so many books. And you can, even just here in Thailand, reimburse me for the printing costs, where you're not actually having to pay a significant amount of money to acquire a set of the teachings of the Buddha that are going to lead to your enlightenment. So I'm going to pause here and see if you guys have any questions on these three traditions or anything about the history of how the teachings of the Buddha have kind of made their way into the world to where we are today. And then after questions, if you guys have any questions, I'm going to go into talking about the actual misunderstandings that you're going to see in various parts of the world related to the teachings of the Buddha. So if you'd like to ask questions, you can put those into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom. Or in Zoom, you can raise your hand electronically and ask any questions or follow-up questions that you like. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So I'm going to move into sharing with you what I shared in the book, which are 9 common misunderstandings. And all throughout the book, I'm sharing teachings of what are the actual teachings of the Buddha. And just in doing that, it clears up a lot of misunderstandings that people are having. But here, these are things that I haven't necessarily addressed in other parts of the book. So that's why I'm calling them out here at the very end of the book. So the first one that I'll share and talk about that you'll see commonly in the Theravada tradition is what is referred to here in Thai as Guat Nam, and this translates as pouring water ceremony. What this is where an individual might go to a teacher or a temple or an ordained practitioner, and they might make an offering practicing generosity in order to have the continuation of the teachings of the Buddha be shared in the world. We refer to this as merit, that whenever you're practicing generosity towards the continued sharing of the teachings of the Buddha, where you're sharing your time, effort, energy, and resources, this would be referred to as merit. And what people believe in the ceremony that they do as part of this is that once you make an offering, then somebody might ask you to go get this little bowl in this little urn of water, or they might just be around, and they ask you to pour this water out as they're chanting. And what they believe is that whatever goodness or whatever beneficial results that you're acquiring for making this offering of merit and practicing generosity, that you're now transferring that to your dead relatives or somebody else. And while this is a really interesting thought, and it's very warming to think that you could do something good and pass it over to somebody else, this isn't actually possible. The Buddha teaches us, and you can see the truth for yourself, that the natural law of karma is based on your decisions, your results, that it's not about somebody else creating karma for you, that whatever you experience in life is a result of your decisions. It's not possible for somebody else to make decisions and then transfer the benefit of that to somebody else. And back when I taught chapter 9 in this book series, in this first book, you can remember perhaps where the Buddha talked about that you are the owner and the heir of your karma. Any karma that you do, either wholesome or unwholesome, you are going to experience that. And if you understand the generosity in production of merit, then if you think back to chapter 10, when I taught about what is merit, I taught you about how one of the benefits of practicing generosity, the primary benefit, is that you're training your mind to eliminate craving, desire, attachment. This is the cause of discontent feelings, that because your mind is holding on to things very tightly, you use breathing mindfulness meditation to train the mind to let go and help it to build in that quality. But then you also practice generosity, which trains the mind to let go, let go, let go. And that benefit of practicing generosity and producing merit, it's not possible to transfer that to somebody else. So even though you'll see this rite, ritual, ceremony in various temples, it's not actually true, and it's not actually based on what the Buddha taught. And you can see this through your own learning, through your own reflection and your own practice, that it's just not possible to transfer the benefits of the decisions that you're making to somebody else in that way. And then the second one here is in Thai referred to as namon, or we might refer to this as blessed water. What this is during a event, a ordained practitioner will have a bowl of water, just regular water, and they will burn a candle and drip wax into this water. And as they're doing this, they will be chanting. And now they think that by the end of this, that the water has now become this blessed water, that it's somehow special, that it's been chanted over, and now there's been water that has had this candle dripped in it, and now this is blessed water. And what they will do is they will take this end of some kind of straw, this straw kind of gathered together, it looks like the end of a broom kind of, and they dip it in this water and they sprinkle it around on the various people that are around. And people think that if this water hits you, that you're now blessed and somehow this is going to help you in your life. But during the lifetime of the Buddha, if you go back to his original teachings in the Pali Canon, he actually talks about this. He talks about this blessed water or holy water or sacred water, and he explains how he doesn't practice this because it promotes wrong view. That if you thought that this water sprinkled on you is going to promote some kind of purity in your mind, then you're not understanding the journey to enlightenment, that the real problem is these pollutions in the mind, and in order to address that, you need to cultivate wisdom. And there's nothing about having water sprinkled on you that is going to cultivate wisdom. With the purpose of water is to clean, right? Or to drink, or something like this. The purpose of this water, you can't create some kind of blessed water, and when you sprinkle this water on you, it's instantly going to produce some kind of magical thing for you. If you go out into the world having had this water sprinkled on you, and you're aggressive and hostile and bitter and harsh with people through your intentions, your speech, and your actions, it doesn't matter how much of this blessed water has been sprinkled on you, you're going to experience unwholesome results. That if you're bitter and harsh and hostile to people, this is your decisions through your intentions, speech, and actions. And because you're putting that out, that's what's going to come back to you. This blessed water can erase that or eradicate that. Or for example, say you stole somebody's car or you robbed a bank. You can't go to a monk and have this water sprinkled on you and now it's going to fix and cure all of those things. Because the natural law of karma is cause and effect, or action and result. It's the results of your decisions. It's not mystical or magical. It's not punishments and rewards. It's not about who's at fault or who's to blame. It's literally the cause and there's effect, or there's an action and there's a result. It's the results of your decisions, that it's your life, your decisions, and your results. So having water sprinkled on you, okay, it might feel refreshing. It might be something that cools you down, or you might drink some water in order to hydrate the body, but that's not going to eliminate your unwholesome results of your unwise decisions. You need to cultivate wisdom in order to make wiser decisions, to go out into the world and be polite, kind, friendly, and respectful to people. And this is what's going to produce the beneficial results in your life, not any kind of water that's sprinkled on you. So this is one of the misunderstandings that you will see commonly within the Theravada tradition. And then there's another one that's called here in Thai, Sai Sin. We might translate this to say sacred thread. What this is that if you go visit a teacher or a Dain practitioner or someone like this, and you might have a conversation, at the end, they might tie this string onto your wrist, and it's thought that this string has some kind of special power, special benefit. But there's nothing that can be tied on your body that has any special benefit. The real benefit in that situation is that you went and talked with a teacher. You went and talked with an ordained practitioner. You cultivated wisdom. The string itself isn't producing any kind of benefit. Now, if you look down at the string and you see the string and it reminds you to be polite, kind, friendly, respectful to people, okay, it's the being polite, kind, friendly, respectful to people that is actually producing the beneficial results in your life. That's the wisdom that you cultivated in the practice that you're now doing in daily life in order to make wise decisions. It's not the string itself that is producing any beneficial results. But unfortunately, these things have been pervasive throughout the world. You'll see these in a lot of different places. And it's promoting what the Buddha referred to as wrong view. This is why the Buddha didn't do it. What wrong view would be is to think that anything other than your own mind is actually causing your discontent feelings. All your anger, sadness, frustration, and all those discontent feelings, it's being caused by your own cravings, desires, attachments, the longing, the yearning. It's being caused by the mind itself. So by establishing right view, by studying the first teaching of the Buddha, which is the Four Noble Truths, you can firmly get onto the path to enlightenment where you have this breakthrough to understanding what's actually causing your discontent feelings. And I share this at the beginning of the program, and we've revisited this at least 4, 5, 6 times throughout the program because it's so crucial and it's so important to understand that I be sure that I'm covering this throughout this program at multiple times. So if you're coming here at the end of the program, you're going to be learning about the Four Noble Truths here in a few weeks. And if you've been studying in this program for any length of time, then you've learned the Four Noble Truths and you know the ultimate cause of your discontent feelings is the craving, the desire, the attachment, the longing, the yearning, where if the mind gets what it wants, it gets pleasant feelings. But if it doesn't get what it wants, it gets painful feelings. And this is the unenlightened mind going up and down and up and down, based on cravings, desires, attachments. So there's no ceremony, there's no rite or ritual, there's no worship that you can do to cultivate the wisdom to understand what's causing these discontent feelings and then to eliminate them. You're going to need to cultivate wisdom in order to accomplish that goal. But you'll see these commonly throughout the Buddhist world, and you'll see other things as well that we're going to talk about here in a moment. But this is 3 just to get us started. And what I'm going to do here is open up to any questions that you guys have related to these 3. Again, you can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So I'm going to move on to the next 3 to be able to help you understand these next 3. And then we have 3 more after that before I finish up with all the individual 9 misunderstandings that are very common in the world, and that this will help you to understand the path to enlightenment. This 4th one is something related to ordained practitioners. Some people refer to them as bhikkhus or bhikkhunis. The bhikkhus are the male ordained practitioners and the bhikkhunis are the female ordained practitioners. If you spend time around ordained practitioners, again, somebody might think that every ordained practitioner must be learning and practicing the original teachings of the Buddha and that they would have a very well-developed practice of these teachings, either enlightened or very close to it. But this isn't actually true. Even during the lifetime of the Buddha, this wasn't actually true. There were people who were ordained that weren't anywhere close to enlightenment, and they were doing many unwise things, perhaps. And the Buddha talks about this at different times during his teachings and how you should consider these kinds of situations. So ordained practitioners will sometimes study with me, and I put this into the book and into my classes so that they can learn. And there's something for you to learn here as well, that in the ordained community, they're oftentimes taught that they are above household practitioners, that they are practicing a higher number of precepts, so therefore they're higher than you as a household practitioner. In my opinion, this would be very unwise to have this perspective, and this is actually going to hinder an individual from getting to enlightenment. Because the way that the Buddha explained it is he explained that the ordained path is actually the lowest form of livelihood that you could practice, because he was a prince destined to become the king, and he stepped down from that and he went into this life of homelessness where he walked down the street accepting donations of food and clothing and water and shelter and medical care, and he was looking to humble his mind and see himself as equal as everybody else. But nowadays, 2,500 years later, people have really propped the ordained practitioners up really high. And if an ordained practitioner allows this to fill their mind, there can be this conceit or this arrogance, this pride, this boastfulness, thinking that they are above others and looking down on others. And one of the things you might see here is that if you why to a ordained practitioner, showing respect to them with your hands together, they may not why you back. They may have been taught that you don't show respect to household practitioners because you're higher than they are. Well, as an ordained practitioner, if you practice that, you're actually going to not be able to experience enlightenment because your mind still has conceit and arrogance and pride and boastfulness. And right away, it's not going to be able to experience enlightenment because of that and other things as well. But you can actually eradicate that. Even though other people around you might be practicing that as an ordained practitioner, that doesn't mean you need to practice that. If I was ordained, I would go around and I would show respect to all the household practitioners, because as an ordained practitioner, it's the household practitioners that are supporting the ordained practitioners to live their life. And if it wasn't for the household practitioners, the ordained practitioners wouldn't be able to live the life that they do, where they're supported and have all the ability to have food, clothing, water, shelter, and medical care provided to them so that they can get closer and closer to enlightenment. Ordaining and living at a temple is like being in the womb of a woman. In the womb of a woman, this is the perfect, most ideal environment for an individual to grow into a human being. And the same thing is true about a monastic environment, that this is the very best environment for an individual to grow and get to enlightenment if the original teachings of the Buddha are being shared there. So it's the household practitioners that are providing this environment for ordained practitioners or a teacher like me to be able to exist in the world, where we just focus on learning and developing and examining the teachings and then sharing those with our students to be able to then help them get closer and closer to enlightenment. So as an ordained practitioner, I would encourage them to have enormous amounts of respect and appreciation and gratitude for the household practitioners, because it's them that are providing this womb in which to grow within. And showing respect and gratitude to the household practitioners, one, by just gesturing and showing your respect, but two, sharing the teachings that are actually going to help them to get to enlightenment. And in this way, there's this mutual support that the Buddha taught that is going to allow the continuation of the teachings of the Buddha. So if you're around ordained practitioners and you show respect to them and they choose not to show respect back to you, that's okay. That's their practice. The goal of the teachings of the Buddha isn't to go around and try to change other people and force other people to do things your way. You're not going to get to peacefulness by trying to convince ordained practitioners to why you and to show you respect. Instead, if you know what is wise, you practice what is wise, which is showing respect and gratitude to all people around you, whether they choose to show you respect or not. Because of the natural laws and the universal truth of impermanence, you already know that when you show respect to people, 100% of the people aren't going to show respect back to you. This is the universal truth of impermanence. So if you know what's wise and you show respect and someone respects you back, okay, wonderful. If they choose not to respect you back, then okay, then that's their practice. It's affecting them. But by you choosing to show politeness, kindness, friendliness, and respect, this is good for your mind and very helpful for your mind, where you can remain humble and down to earth. I've shared some words of the Buddha in this particular chapter to help ordained practitioners and to help household practitioners to be able to see what the Buddha taught on this important topic of eliminating conceit from the mind and how it leads to enlightenment. This is the words of the Buddha related to this particular topic. And he talks about it in other places too, but this is just one particular teaching. It's titled, Gain, Honor, and Praise Are an Obstacle Even for an Arahant. An Arahant is an enlightened being. This is an individual who's eliminated all the 10 fetters and completely purified the mind. So here the Buddha shares, monks, gain, honor, and praise, I say, are an obstacle even for a monk who is an Arahant, one with taints destroyed. The Buddha is saying this gain, honor, and praise is an obstacle for someone who is enlightened and has their taints destroyed. So then, this is one of his students. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda asked Master Teacher Gotama, why, Venerable Sir, are gain, honor, and praise an obstacle even for an Arahant with taints destroyed? So his student, who's Ananda, very close student, is like, hold on a second. If somebody's enlightened and they have their mind completely purified and their mind is peaceful and joyful, why would gain, honor, and praise be an obstacle for them? Because they're already enlightened. This shouldn't be an obstacle for them, is essentially what the Ananda is getting to. So the Buddha comes back in and says, I do not say, Ananda, that gain, honor, and praise are an obstacle to his unshakable liberation of mind, but I say they are an obstacle to his attainment of those peaceful dwellings in this very life, which are achieved by one who resides diligent, dedicated, and determined. So dreadful, Ananda, are gain, honor, and praise, so bitter, vile, obstructive, to achieving the unsurpassed security from bondage or enlightenment. So here, let me explain this to you. What the Buddha is saying is, I didn't say that once somebody's enlightened and their mind is unshakable and it's been liberated, that gain, honor, and praise is an obstacle to them. What I say is that it's an obstacle for them to attain enlightenment, which is going to protect their mind. If they're diligent, dedicated, and determined, then they wouldn't have this conceit. They would eliminate this boastfulness and this arrogance based on gain, honor, and praise, because it's going to obstruct you from getting to this enlightened mental state. Therefore, Ananda, you should train yourselves thus. We will abandon the arisen gain, honor, praise, and we will not let the arisen gain, honor, and praise persist, obsessing our mind. Thus should you train yourselves. So what he's saying is, if you experience gain, honor, and praise, meaning maybe you're at work and somebody acknowledges your hard work, or maybe you get a certificate at work for some achievement, or maybe some other aspect of your life, maybe somebody's just complimenting you that you look beautiful, or you look handsome, or you've done a really good job with something. Don't allow that conceit to rise up in the mind. The Buddha is teaching you to train your mind to cut that off and let it go. While other people may prop you up and think that you're so great and you're so wonderful, the Buddha is saying, no, be humble. You need to be humble. This is what's going to allow you to eliminate your conceit in your mind. Because as you're becoming more and more enlightened, more and more wise, people are going to take note of that. They're going to see that you're friendly, you're polite, you're respectful, that you're getting along very easily with people around you, that you're making wise decisions, that you've got your life very well organized. They're going to notice this about your life, and they're going to probably compliment you, because things that they're really struggling and having difficulties with, it's so easy for you because you have such wisdom about the path to enlightenment. So as you start hearing all this gain, honor, and praise, these compliments that are coming to you, it's important to remain humble and don't allow your mind to become conceited, because this is going to hinder you from getting to enlightenment. If you get a promotion at work, or you have a certain job title, or you're making a certain amount of money, don't allow the mind to be conceited about that. Or if you have a really nice car, nice house, nice clothes, don't allow your mind to get conceited about that. Remain humble. This is going to help you to be able to get to enlightenment. So anytime you see that conceit rising up where the ego is trying to be boastful or arrogant or prideful, you cut that off and let it go and reside humble. Here's another teaching from the Buddha on this same topic. And remember, he has multiple about this topic. It's titled, This Spiritual Life Is Not Lived for the Sake of Deceiving People. Monks, this spiritual life is not lived for the sake of deceiving people and persuading them, nor for the benefit of gain, honor, and praise, nor for the benefit of winning in debates, nor with the thought let the people know me thus, but rather, this spiritual life is lived for the sake of restraint, abandoning, freedom from strong feelings, and elimination. That's elimination of the discontent feelings. So the Buddha is saying, learning this path and becoming wise and training your mind to get to this peace and joy where the mind's concentrated and focused, you have clarity of mind, deep memory, and all these other benefits that you're going to experience on the path to enlightenment. The goal of this path isn't to get gain, honor, and praise from others, where it's like, oh, wow, look at him or look at her. They're a Buddhist practitioner. Look at them. Aren't they so wise? That's not the ultimate goal to progress on this path to enlightenment. It's to eliminate the strong feelings. It's to eliminate the discontent feelings. That's the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal isn't to win in debates or arguments or fights, because you're going to gain a lot of wisdom on this path to enlightenment. And if you went out there and you were arguing and fighting and showing people how wise you are and how smart you are, you're not actually going to get to enlightenment. You're going to hinder yourself. So it's not about let the people know me thus. Look how smart I am. Look how wise I am. That's not what the path to enlightenment is all about. It's about training your mind to eliminate these discontent feelings. So here, the Buddha is helping you to be able to see one of the goals on the path to enlightenment is to remain humble and eliminate these discontent feelings. So if you're around ordained practitioners, or if you're an ordained practitioner, just understand that it's wise to be humble. That if you're around ordained practitioners and you show respect to them and they choose to not show respect back, okay, that's their practice. You would like to continue to reside peaceful and joyful and know that you're making wise decisions. And if you're an ordained practitioner, I would encourage you to look at the teachings of the Buddha, because you most likely have been taught that you're above others. And this is very unwise to think this way, because it's actually hindering you from being able to experience enlightenment and experience improved relationships where you have the support around you from the people who are there to support you, which is the household practitioners. If you're not showing appreciation, gratitude, and respect to the people who are supporting you in life, they're not going to provide you any more support. So it's very important to show that respect and gratitude to the people who are supporting you. And sometimes that can just be a simple thank you and a why, or some kind of acknowledgement of respect for what they're choosing to do to support you in your life as an ordained practitioner. This fifth one is about chanting or mantras. You guys probably know that I use chanting in order to ease the mind into meditation, and this actually helps you to get more benefit out of the meditation itself. Not everybody's going to choose to chant as part of their journey to enlightenment. It's not required to chant in order to get to enlightenment. The origins of chanting started during the lifetime of the Buddha, because he taught in the oral tradition where everything he taught was oral, so that once every 2 weeks his students would come together and they would recite the teachings word for word for word as a way to commit them to memory. And this was required during the lifetime of the Buddha, because you wouldn't have any other way to remember the teachings. While I say it's required, it's something that you needed to do, right? The Buddha didn't require you to do it, but in terms of getting to enlightenment, you would have no other way to remember the teachings, because there wasn't books or YouTube videos or podcasts or any of these kinds of things to be able to help you to revisit the teachings over and over and over again. The way you revisited the teachings was through chanting. So every 2 weeks, people would chant in order to commit the teachings to memory. And that's the origins of chanting. But now, 2,500 years later, there are some people who think that chanting has this mystical, magical benefit. Whereas if you chant this special chant, you'll get this extra long life. Or if you chant this special chant, you'll get your boyfriend back, or your girlfriend back, or your husband or your wife. Or if you chant this special chant, you'll get this wealth or something like this. Or maybe you instantly get to enlightenment by chanting this particular chant. Well, these things are untrue. There's no words that you can say that have this mystical, magical benefit. This is the ego kicking in and thinking that I can chant something that's going to immediately produce some kind of benefit in the world. Well, just like I share with you, don't believe what other people are sharing with you about chants and other things in the world, also don't believe me either. You need to be able to learn, reflect, and practice and see the truth for yourself. That here, I'm teaching you and helping you learn intellectually that chanting and mantras, they don't have any special mystical powers to help you have an extra long life, for example. And now what you do is you reflect on that. Well, if that's true, that chanting does help you to have an extra long life, then you should be able to go into a temple that's teaching this, and you would see people sitting around that are 150, 200, 300 years old. And if you saw that, then you would know the truth, that these these chants actually do work to produce an extra long life. But if you go to a temple and this temple is saying, hey, chant this special chant and you're going to get this extra long life, then you would see lots of people who are 150, 200, 300 years old because they've been chanting this for multiple generations. Or if they say, chant this special chant and you'll get rich and wealthy, which doesn't necessarily lead to happiness, but people sometimes aspire for wealth and think that chanting or mantra is going to help you to accomplish that, then you would see at that particular temple, everybody would be wealthy. Everybody would have lots and lots and lots of money, right? So you can test this for yourself and see that it's not actually true. Or if somebody says, chant this special chant and you're going to get your boyfriend back, okay, do it and see. Getting your boyfriend back isn't going to come from chanting. The reason why somebody might have split up from their boyfriend or girlfriend is based on the difficulties and challenges that are being experienced in the relationship, and having discussions and talking and being kind and polite and respectful to each other. That's what's going to actually produce harmonious relationships in your life, not any kind of chanting or mantras. So it's really easy for the mind to believe that you can chant something and then that there's this mystical, magical benefit, when in reality, it's real work to train your mind to cultivate wisdom and to practice that wisdom in day-to-day life. But that's where the real results come in, where by you cultivating wisdom and applying that in your day-to-day life, that's when you're going to actually experience true results, and you can see what the real benefits of the teachings of the Buddha are, rather than believing in any kind of auspicious or superstitious things. The Buddha shares in his actual teachings that there's nothing auspicious or superstitious about his teachings, that there are no rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship that he taught. In order to even get to the first stage of enlightenment, someone would need to eliminate the rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship. So if you're going to a temple where there's rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship being practiced, you can be sure that there aren't people there that are even at the first stage of enlightenment, most likely. And otherwise, they wouldn't be performing those rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship, because this is misleading people down a path to not understand what the true problem is, which is the unknowing of true reality and the lack of wisdom in the mind. So I teach chanting as a way to ease the mind into meditation, that it helps you to exercise the mind, cultivating awareness of mind and developing concentration and memory, helping you to have awareness of the breath, so that this way you actually get more benefit out of the meditation itself. That if you're chanting, it's helping you to kind of invigorate the mind and bring some attentiveness and alertness to the mind, and then also get awareness of the breath, so that then you can get the benefit of the meditation right from the very beginning. Where you could just start meditating if you like, and that's fine. There's people who do that and actually get to enlightenment. You don't need chanting in order to get to enlightenment. There's people who are enlightened that don't actually chant. But if you would like to use chanting as a way to benefit your meditation sessions, you can do that, and I teach that at different times in the various courses and programs that I share. The core central teaching of the Buddha to get to enlightenment is the Eightfold Path. There's eight individual factors that an individual needs to learn and practice and dial into their life very closely in order to get to enlightenment. And when you look at the Eightfold Path, which is the path to enlightenment, you don't see anywhere that it discusses chanting, because chanting isn't required in order to get to enlightenment. But you do need to learn the teachings. You need to examine them, investigate them. You need to reflect on them and see that they're true. And you need to practice them. And part of that practice is meditation, but you're not required to actually chant in order to get to enlightenment. But you can learn chanting if you'd like a certain activity to exercise the mind and get more benefit out of the meditation practice itself. So this is all about chanting or mantras. Then the sixth one that I'll share with you is about the statues of the Buddha. That all throughout the world, you'll see various statues of the Buddha. These came about 200 or 300 years after the death of the Buddha. He didn't teach people to make statues of him, but 200 or 300 years after his death, the people that were practicing his teachings, they came in contact with people in Greece that were making statues of their gods, because they believed in multiple different gods, and they were making statues of these different gods. And these individuals who came in contact with the people in Greece were like, who do we have to make a statue out of? And it was the Buddha. So they started making statues out of the Buddha. And this is why you'll see some statues that look very much inspired by Greek artists, because they look very Grecian. Or if you go to China, you'll see statues that look very Chinese. Or if you go to Japan, you'll see statues that look very Japanese. And there's statues here in Thailand that some people might say look very Thai. And this is because the individual artists who are creating these statues, they would like the Buddha to look like them. And that's how they view an individual person. But the Buddha didn't actually look like any of these statues. I've never actually seen a statue that looks like the actual Buddha. That these statues are being depicted in such a way that he has a crown on his head. And this is coming from the time when he was a king, that he did potentially wear a crown at different times. Actually, not a king, as a prince. He was destined to become the king. That he might have worn a crown at different times. I wasn't there. I don't necessarily know. But that is potentially depicting that period of time of his life where people knew that he was part of the royal family, and maybe they assumed that he wore a crown, because the people who lived 200 or 300 years after his death, they didn't actually live during his lifetime, so they didn't actually know what he looked like. So they just cast statues based on what they thought he might look like. This picture that I use throughout all the different materials that I share, this was commissioned by a temple here in Thailand where the artist was asked to look at the original teachings of the Buddha from the Pali Canon, where the Buddha describes what he actually looked like during his lifetime. And he was asked to, or she was asked to, make this artwork that looks like the Buddha as it's described in the original source teachings. And if you look at this image, he looks just like you. He looks just like me in terms of a human being. He's not wearing a crown on his head because he describes that he shaved his hair during his lifetime. So I think it's really helpful to humanize a Buddha so that you guys understand that the Buddha isn't this special being that is so far beyond any imagination of what you could potentially accomplish. That yes, the Buddha got to enlightenment, and a Buddha gets to enlightenment by themselves without the help of any teachers or any guides. And there's other criteria that make a Buddha as well. But just like he was a human being and he got to enlightenment, you're a human being and you can get to enlightenment as well. Whereas if people put the Buddha up really high, then perhaps they think that enlightenment is far outside their reaches and they're not able to accomplish it, when in reality you can. So the more that you associate the Buddha as being a human being and seeing him look and appear as a human being, somebody who looks just like you or I, this can help you to humanize a Buddha and know that you can get to enlightenment just like him. Just like you urinate and defecate and you maybe pick your nose and you fart and you have all these other things that go on, I guarantee you that a Buddha experiences all those exact same things just like you. So by humanizing a Buddha, it will actually help you to be able to associate the qualities of enlightenment to what you can accomplish as well. These statues of the Buddha have gone even further than this, that it's not just depicting him in a way that he didn't appear, but nowadays some people actually think that the spirit of the Buddha is inside these statues, which the Buddha never taught. He never taught anything about that. And what you'll see is you'll see people that will feed these statues. They'll give them food and water. You'll see people praying to these statues, asking the Buddha to come and intervene on their behalf. But this isn't what the Buddha taught at all. He lived over 2,500 years ago and he died, and you'll never see him back here in the human world ever again, that he's never going to be reborn. So he did his work and he shared what he needed to share, and now he's done. He's not going to be able to help you now that he's actually dead and gone. He did a significant amount of work during his life to be able to help you, so that now, 2,500 years later, through learning and practicing his teachings, you can actually get to enlightenment. So if you believed that the spirit of the Buddha is in those statues and you need to feed them and you need to worship these statues, this is taking you down the path of wrong view. And I share all these different things, not just this one about the statues, but all the others, because I used to do all these things. I used to practice pouring out the water of Guat Nam, and I used to practice getting the water sprinkled on me, and I used to practice getting the strings tied on me. And at different times, I used to, even in the past, long ago, tie strings on people's wrists and sprinkle the water. And I had tons of Buddha statues at one time, and I used to feed them and give them water and all these other things. And you can see that that isn't going to lead to your elimination of sadness. That isn't going to lead to your elimination of anger and hostility and bitterness. It's not going to improve your relationships. It's not going to produce concentration and clarity and focus and these other qualities of the enlightened mind. So the statues that are out there. They're beautiful. They're amazing artworks. And it's quite admirable that people have such dedication to devote resources to sharing these statues with people and creating these kind of artworks with people. But you don't need a Buddha statue in order to get to enlightenment. You're not required to go out and purchase one in order to get to enlightenment. If you choose to do that, that's your choice, but it's not required in order to actually get to enlightenment. So let me know if you guys have any questions on any of these. Again, you can put that into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like. Okay, we have some things coming in here on Facebook. There's a gentleman saying, thanks for your kind support to develop my inner purity. You're welcome, sir. Pleased to help you. And Mayuli is asking a question. Growing up, I was exposed to Guatnam, Namon, and Sai Sin. I never understood it and was unable to wrap my mind around it. After studying the true words of the Buddha, I now understand why. Okay, perfect. That's great, Mayuli. Yeah, getting to the true teachings of the Buddha is surely going to help you. And the Buddha even talks about that as just needed in order to get to the first stage of enlightenment, that you wouldn't even be able to get to the first stage of enlightenment without having the true teachings of the Buddha. So this is wonderful for you. Looks like Marcy has a question. Go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Teacher David. So one of the things that was taught is the Buddha states about setting up mindfulness before you begin meditation. And I would understand that chanting is a way of setting up mindfulness. Another way to set up mindfulness that I have been practicing, and I'm looking for a little bit of guidance to see if maybe it seems to be working, but I just want to make sure that I'm setting up mindfulness the correct way. So when I go into meditation, I usually will kind of like what I call purge the mind. Like I do a lot of reflecting about my day, things of where I could have practiced the Noble Eightfold Path better, been a little closer to it and kind of try to dial it in. And then I go into where pay homage and take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, which seems to bring peace into my mind. And then I recite the Noble Eightfold Path, right view, right intention, right speech. And I kind of go through pulling from memory what each bracket is. And then I go into meditation. Is that a beneficial way of setting up mindfulness? It seems to be working for me, but I'm not sure if maybe I am, how would you say, fully setting myself up.
Yeah, if you're doing this like prior to meditation where you're not closing your eyes and doing this kind of thing, I think that this can be helpful for you because you're reciting the Eightfold Path and bringing that to the forefront of your mind, and that will help you to then practice it in daily life. Whereas if somebody had their eyes closed in meditation posture and then doing that, the mind can sometimes become confused of what am I doing versus this reflection versus this meditation period. So as long as you're able to keep that separate and you see, okay, this is my inward looking reflection and my introspection and me kind of developing awareness of mind. And now, okay, I'm done with that. And now I'm moving into this meditation. I think that, yeah, this can be beneficial for you for not only cultivating awareness of mind, but remembering the teachings to be able to then practice them.
All right, because I do get in a position for meditation and I do close my eyes when I do this. So you think I would probably be more beneficial if I have more of an open eyes awareness session of mindfulness before I close my eyes and go into meditation?
Perhaps. As long as there's kind of like a clear line that's delineating, this is my reflection and introspection and this is my meditation, and you can see that very clearly. Okay. This is what you would like to do, because when you get to that part of meditation, you're cutting off thoughts, right? You're cutting off things and bringing it back to the breath. So you would like to be sure there's a clear delineation between that. So if you're in meditation position with your eyes closed and you found that that's working for you, okay, you know, do that, but just be sure there's this clear delineation. You could try what I'm suggesting for a week or two and see if it has any impact to the mind. This is how you know the truth for yourself. And you can test it. And since I've never done what it is that you're describing 100%, then this is something that you can test for yourself and see what is it produced for the mind.
And thank you very much, Teacher David. And my last question, Teacher David, is I'm starting to build a relationship with God, and I'm having a hard time figuring out Well, my question to you is, when do you interact with God? Do you do it right before the chanting and you go into your meditation? Do it after? Like, I would say I'm having a challenge trying to fit it into my kind of establishing a routine of it.
Sure. So first, I'll share that it's not required to have a relationship with God in order to get to enlightenment. And this is something I've shared in chapter 18. But some students choose to have a relationship with God. And I taught in chapter 18 how to accomplish that and still be able to get to enlightenment, or how to have no relationship with God and still get to enlightenment. So for me, I choose to have a relationship with God. It's been only beneficial to me. He doesn't intervene on my behalf or do anything like that. I still need to do the work. But a relationship with God has been most helpful in my practice. So what I do is when I'm here at home and I'm doing my own meditation myself, or if I'm doing it even at the temple or somewhere else and I'm doing meditation by myself because it's my own personal relationship, I will do a prayer. But it's not the prayer that you might have been taught growing up where you're asking God to change things and do things. It's the Lord's Prayer of Our Father who art in heaven. And I describe this in the book to explain the meaning of this, of why I do this, and that I let people know that this isn't required in order to get to enlightenment. So I do that very first, like right from the very beginning. And I did that before when I used to have more interactions with God. Like, he's around all the time. There's interaction that's possible at any given time of my day. But at one time, there was a lot of interaction between me and God. But now we're on very good terms. I'm doing all the things that I need to do. He's doing all the things he needs to do. We don't need to have deep conversations anymore the way we used to. He understands me, I understand him, and we're just doing our work and what we need to do in this world in order to help as many people as we can. So that's why at this point in my life, I just do the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and the Our Father. And then from there, I change positions because I do that on my knees. And then I change positions into my meditation posture. And then I do the chanting if my voice isn't like this and I'm not sick and I'm not teaching a lot of classes. Because sometimes when I'm teaching a lot of classes, I'm doing a lot of chanting and my voice is wearing out. So at home, when I'm doing my own personal practice nowadays, because I'm teaching so much, I'm frequently not chanting when I'm at home. I'm just going right into the meditation. But I've developed some awareness of mine with the prayer beforehand and just kind of easing into meditation that way.
Thank you, Teacher David. So in the beginning, when you were building your relationship with God, though, your conversations with him were a little bit more in depth, a little bit more deep. Okay, so I guess that's because, you know, I want to be thankful to him for creating this world and creating the natural laws of existence and, you know, providing us with free will. But there's also other things that I like to talk to him about, not ask him for, but pretty much, you know, talk to him about, like, you know, I could have had this situation where I could have practiced the path a little bit more with right speech and stuff like that. Is that the kind of conversations you would have with him?
Yeah, just talking about anything. And then it doesn't mean he's going to immediately talk back, right? It just means that, you know, I'm just kind of sharing with him, like, hey, you know, I'm doing this, I'm here to do this. Like, any kind of conversation you like to have, he's there to love and support all beings equally.
Thank you so much, Teacher David, for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. We have something coming in here from Mark on Zoom. He says, what was it that caused you to stop the ritual stuff? Was it a slow realization, or did you have a, oh, damn, type moment? So when I was in America, I was sharing Thai massage, I was sharing Thai culture, and I was teaching what I knew at the time to be the teachings of the Buddha, which isn't what I'm sharing now. But I was sharing what I thought were the teachings of the Buddha at that time, which there was full of misunderstandings. When I left America and came to Thailand, I got rid of pretty much everything. I brought, like, basically clothes to Thailand when I came here, my bicycle and a couple little things like that. So I left everything behind and stripped all that behind me. And my life in America was not so peaceful. It was not so joyful. So I was doing all the feeding of the statues, all those other things that I mentioned to you, and it didn't have the effect on my mind. So once I started getting into the actual true teachings of the Buddha and I saw the actual effect that they had, and I didn't have any statues around me at that time because we don't have any statues at our house. And I wasn't doing any of the feeding or any of the namon or the strings or any of that other stuff. I knew that none of that stuff is what led to enlightenment, because it was cultivating wisdom in the true teachings of the Buddha that leads to this improved mental state. It's not any of those rites, rituals, ceremonies. So it wasn't like an aha moment. It was kind of like a natural progression of me going forward in life and then ultimately coming to the original teachings of the Buddha and then seeing what he taught, because that was the real aha moment, if there was an aha moment, where the Buddha talks about blessed water, because these things were going on during his lifetime too. And he says, I do not do this, right? He says, I do not practice this. And he says, because it promotes wrong view. And he encourages his ordained practitioners not to do it as well. During the lifetime of the Buddha, there were Brahmin priests, who we would probably consider Hindu priests nowadays, that were performing rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship. The common person was taught that they couldn't pray to God, that it was only this class of people of the Brahmin who were born into this family that had the ability to talk with God. So the common person was taught to pay the Brahmin money, and then they would pray on your behalf, and you were supposed to go home and your life was going to get better. And these Brahmin priests were essentially doing all these rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship. And the Buddha was teaching how these things don't lead to enlightenment, and it was his ordained practitioners that were getting to enlightenment, and the household practitioners too. But then after he died, there's been this gradual transition where the ordained practitioners throughout the world have essentially become the Brahmin priests of the time of the Buddha. During the time of the Buddha, these Brahmin priests were taking in a certain amount of money for the rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship that they were doing, and they weren't interested in stopping to do that because that's how they sustained their life. Well, nowadays, the ordained practitioners have become that, where people will go to ordained practitioners, pay them money to do certain ceremonies, and then they're supposed to go home and their life's supposed to get better. And some of these ordained practitioners are holding on to those rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship, even if you show them what the original teachings are or they interact with the original teachings. They're not interested in that because there's a certain amount of craving or clinging to these rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship and the money that is being made for performing those things. So this is why we see this transference from the Brahmin priests to the ordained practitioners. But when I read the original teachings of the Buddha and I realized that he's teaching the very thing that the ordained practitioners are doing and he taught not to do this, this is where you start to understand, like, these ordained practitioners, they're not necessarily practicing the original teachings of the Buddha. And this is very unfortunate because people probably look to them as leaders and guides in the world. And if they're not practicing the original teachings, people are being misguided into what the original teachings are. So once I found the original teachings and I could see the truth for myself, the more I got into those teachings, that they improved the condition of my mind, I knew that these rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship weren't actually what the Buddha taught, and they don't lead to enlightenment. Looks like EY has a question. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I actually was pretty much brought up in the Buddhist environment, so I never had any kind of relationship with God or anything else. So I'm just wondering, you know, with all my petty problems in life, should I try to reach out to God, or how to even reach out or communicate to him, you know, like what you do, or, you know, in case if I need any guidance in life or anything like that.
Yeah, sure. There's a class that I taught EY on chapter 18 where I go through this in detail. I would encourage you to get that online class through YouTube or our podcast, and you can hear what I taught, because it's a good hour and a half of me teaching all the various things that you would need to understand if you're going to choose to have a relationship with God. And then after you read the book and after you watch that class, chapter 18, then any questions you have, just let me know.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay, so I don't see any more questions beyond this, so I'm going to move to the last three that I have to share with you guys related to misunderstandings of the teachings of the Buddha. This number seventh one in this particular chapter is talking about how some people refer to Gautama Buddha as a god, an avatar, or a lord. You might hear some people refer to him as Lord Buddha. And I would share that this is unwise to do this, because if you look up the definition of what a lord is, it's exactly the opposite of what the Buddha did and what he practiced and how he conducted himself in the world. So when I looked up this word lord, it means someone or something having power, authority, or influence, a master or a ruler, or to act in a superior and domineering manner towards someone. So this isn't what the Buddha did. He actually did exactly the opposite. He was very humble. He didn't put himself as having power or authority or influence or superiority or domineering manner towards other people. He practiced this humbleness in the mind. So if we use the word Lord referring to the Buddha, there's billions of people in the world who have been learning various things about various teachers who have existed over the course of history. And some people have been taught that Jesus Christ is the only Lord and Savior. And if somebody was practicing Christianity and thinking that Jesus Christ was the only Lord and Savior, and if you acknowledge any other Lord, that this would be very harmful for you, then when somebody refers to Lord Buddha, they're immediately going to reject his teachings that could actually help them to experience the elimination of discontentedness and get into the peace and joy. Whereas if we represent the Buddha in the way that he described himself, which is as a teacher, an individual who's sharing the truth, he didn't represent himself as a savior, a messiah, or a lord, or anything like that, then Christians can feel comfortable that they're not worshiping a false god and they're not turning their back on the Lord Jesus Christ. So by us referring to the Buddha in the way that he referred to himself, as either in other people refer to him as a master teacher or a teacher, or some people refer to him as the Tathagata, which you're going to hear about here in a moment, and some people refer to him as the Buddha or Gautama Buddha. There's many different ways to refer to him. But as soon as we put this word Lord on his identification and identifying him as a Lord, it will turn away many billions of people that could actually be liberated and experience the peace and joy of the enlightened mental state. And if we turn the Buddha into a god or an avatar, this puts him so far beyond what he actually was, which was a human being. The Buddha wasn't a god because a god doesn't get born through the womb of a woman. The Buddha was born through the womb of a woman. A god doesn't come into existence through the womb of a woman. So you can see the truth for yourself that he isn't a god, that he was a human being. He was a teacher. He was an individual that shared teachings. He had great compassion, this concern for the misfortune of others. And he spent 45 years of his life sharing teachings that will help you get to that peaceful and joyful mental state. And then if you refer to him in the way that he referred to himself, then that opens it up to many other people to be able to access his teachings. There's a large majority of people who come to learn with me that have learned Christian teachings in the past, and they feel comfortable doing that because I don't refer to the Buddha as a Lord, because he never referred to himself that way. There are some people who you might hear refer to blessings related to the teachings of the Buddha. They might say, "May the Buddha bless you," or "May the Lord Buddha bless you," or "May the Triple Gem bless you," which the Triple Gem is the Buddha, the teachings, and the community. Well, there's no blessings in the teachings of the Buddha. You'll never see anywhere in his teachings where he ever blessed anybody. What blessing means, if you look this up, is it means God's favor and protection. It's a prayer asking for God's favor or protection. You'll never see anywhere in the teachings of the Buddha that he blesses anybody, because that's not what leads to enlightenment. Think about how much ego it takes for somebody that's human being to think that they can bless another person. It would take an enormous amount of ego in somebody's mind to think that I can now bless this person and now God is going to protect them because of what I did by putting my hands on them or chanting something or blessing them with some kind of prayer or something like this. So you'll never see anywhere that the Buddha talks about blessings or blessing anybody, but you'll hear other people that will share this. And you should never judge other people if they're doing any of these things that I'm talking about. Never look down on people. Everybody's in their own practice, right? They're learning and growing and evolving. I probably said, you know, "May the Buddha bless you" at some point in my life too. I don't particularly recall saying that, but I may have, right? So we've all done these things potentially at different times, or we may have been around people who have done these things. This isn't about these people are good, these people are bad. That's not what the teachings of the Buddha are about. It's not about putting yourself above or below. It's about helping you understand what's going to lead to improvement in the condition of your mind. So if you're around people who are choosing to say these things or do these things, you should have humbleness and respect and gratitude, just like you would with anybody. You treat everybody equally. You're not necessarily respecting them because they say these blessings, but you're respecting them because they're a human being and it's wise to respect others. So if you notice that people are into these kinds of things, you can just smile, you can just go about your life, because it's not about what other people do that determine whether you get to enlightenment. It's about what you do. If you choose to cultivate wisdom and train your mind, this is what's going to lead to enlightenment. It's not about everybody doing everything exactly the same. You're going to occasionally hear in the news where there's Buddhist monks who are doing things that are very unwise in the world. You'll hear practitioners who are Buddhist or teachers or people like this that are doing things that are very unwise. And just because they're choosing to do something unwise, that doesn't taint the teachings of the Buddha. Because in those situations, those people aren't actually practicing the teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha gave an analogy about this. He talks about a cow and him being a cow. And he talks about if he was walking on soft earth, and this earth had his hoof prints of being a cow imprinted into the earth, and there was a donkey behind him, and this donkey was putting his hoofs in the same hoof prints as the cow being the Buddha, and the donkey was thinking in his mind, I'm a cow, I'm a cow, I'm a cow, I'm a cow. Well, just because he's putting his hooves in the same hoof prints as the cow, and just because his mind is thinking, I'm a cow, I'm a cow, I'm a cow, does that make him a cow? No, that doesn't make him a cow. So the Buddha teaches what makes a being wise and enlightened is based on their actions. By you cultivating wisdom and making wise decisions around your actions, that's what determines whether you're practicing the teachings closely or not. It's not an orange robe and a shaved head that determines whether you're an ordained practitioner or not. What determines whether you're an ordained practitioner or not is whether you're learning and practicing the teachings of the Buddha very closely. Or what makes you a wise teacher is, are you practicing the teachings of the Buddha very closely, making wise decisions? So even though you see other people out there that are doing all these kinds of things, it's not wise to judge them or look down on them. Just focus on your own practice and developing your own wisdom. Even though you might see things in the world where people are using the teachings of the Buddha in unwise ways, or claiming that they're practicing the teachings of the Buddha, or maybe even looking and appearing, remember this analogy of the donkey. So just because someone has a shaved head and wears white clothes or orange robes or whatever other thing, it doesn't mean that they are practicing the teachings of the Buddha very closely. You need to look at the condition of an individual's mind to determine whether this is somebody that you would like to learn with. The Buddha provides guidance on this, where he talks about looking to see if the person's mind is focused and concentrated. Do they have clarity of mind? Do they have deep wisdom? Do they have loving kindness and compassion? You would like to look at these kinds of things. Whereas if you see somebody's mind is muddled and confused and stumbling over words readily and frequently, then this shows that their mind still has a certain level of pollution. And again, we're not looking down on that person, but just understand that this person is most likely not practicing the teachings of the Buddha very closely, and that's why their mind is still kind of cloudy and having difficulty with speaking with focus and clarity. So you're going to see many different things in the world related to the teachings of the Buddha that may or may not actually be his original teachings. And this is a way to help you to be able to see the teachings more closely by talking about the misunderstandings. And one of the big misunderstandings in the world is this last one that I share, which is some people say that if you get to enlightenment, you are a Buddha. Or some people say that you're a Buddha now and you just need to realize this Buddha nature, or you need to attain Buddhahood. Well, the teachings of the Buddha never share this. So while other people might say that everybody's a Buddha and you will be a Buddha when you get to enlightenment, the Buddha himself didn't actually say this. So while you might hear this in the world, you're not going to be a Buddha when you get to enlightenment. There's three primary criteria that make a Buddha a Buddha. Is number one, a Buddha will get to enlightenment by themselves without the help of any teachers or any guides. They independently discover the teachings that it takes to get to enlightenment. Number two, they dedicate the rest of their life to sharing their independently discovered teachings with countless people, and countless people get to enlightenment during that person's lifetime. And then the third criteria of what makes a Buddha is that they preserve their teachings in such a way that countless people can get to enlightenment after their death. So those are the three criteria: is they get to enlightenment by themselves, They dedicate the rest of their life to sharing their teachings, and countless people get to enlightenment. And then they preserve their teachings so that countless more people can get to enlightenment after their death. So you're going to need teachers and guides to get to enlightenment. And you may or may not dedicate the rest of your life to sharing teachings. And you're not going to preserve the teachings because they're already preserved to be able to help other people get to enlightenment. So you can get to enlightenment and you'll be plenty enjoying that mental state, the peace and the joy that comes through in the enlightened mind. You'll be completely satisfied, completely fulfilled. There'll be nothing else in the world that you will want, that your mind will be completely satisfied. But you're not going to be a Buddha at that particular time. And it would be helpful to make sure you understand what a Buddha is so that you don't think that you're actually becoming a Buddha, but instead the mind is getting to this enlightened mental state. It takes a lot of ego to think that one is getting to become a Buddha if they don't even understand what a Buddha is. If somebody doesn't understand what a Buddha is, and yet they're claiming that they are an actual Buddha, this comes from one's own ego. And in my opinion, it lacks respect for an actual Buddha, Gautama Buddha, who actually did the work through the entire remaining time of his life from the age of 35 to 80, where he ultimately gets to enlightenment. And he got to enlightenment through countless lives of developing his mind to get to that point. There is an extensive amount of work that goes into getting to enlightenment as a Buddha. You know all the work that you're doing in order to get to enlightenment with the guidance of a teacher. Can you imagine accomplishing that without the guidance of any teacher? So there's a lot of work, an enormous amount of work that goes into getting to enlightenment as an actual Buddha. And it's best to honor and respect the Buddha for what he actually did by referring to him as a Buddha and not referring to yourself as a Buddha or other people as a Buddha. And to help you understand that not everybody is a Buddha, I share in this chapter some of the words of the Buddha from him to show you how rare it is that an individual that is a Buddha comes into the world. These are actually the words of the Buddha describing how rare it is for an individual to become a Buddha. Here, this one is titled, The Rare Appearance of Five Treasures. He's talking to one of his students here. He says, "Student, the appearance of five treasures is rare in the world. What five? One, the appearance of a Tathagata, an Arahant, a perfectly enlightened one, is rare in the world." So right there, you can see that he's saying it's very rare that an individual arises as a Buddha. Well, if everybody is a Buddha, well, he wouldn't have said that. So he only speaks the truth, and he's sharing that it's very rare for an individual to come into the world that is an actual Buddha. He referred to himself as the Tathagata. This means one who's discovered the truth or one who shares the truth. That's what the word Tathagata means. That's how he often referred to himself. An Arahant is an individual who's eliminated the 10 fetters. So you can get to the point where you've eliminated the 10 fetters and you're an Arahant, but you wouldn't be a perfectly enlightened one. A perfectly enlightened one is an individual who's gotten to enlightenment by themselves without the help of any teachers or any guides. And that is very rare in the world, as you see here. And just for completeness, I'll read the other ones to you as well before I open up to questions that you guys might have. He says, number two, a person who can teach the teachings and discipline proclaimed by a Tathagata is rare in the world. Number three, when the teachings and discipline proclaimed by a Tathagata has been taught, a person who can understand it is rare in the world. Four, when the teachings and discipline proclaimed by a Tathagata has been taught, a person who can understand it and practice it in accordance with the teachings is rare in the world. Five, a grateful and thankful person is rare in the world. Student, the appearance of these five treasures is rare in the world. So you can independently verify this for yourself, that you can see that it's very rare for these things to occur. If you are practicing being grateful and thankful, you can see that maybe it's hard for other people to do that as well. But what the Buddha is saying is it's very rare for someone to be able to teach his teachings. It's very rare for somebody to understand his teachings once they've been taught. And then it's very rare for an individual to be able to practice his teachings once they've actually understood them. And then it's very rare for them to be thankful or grateful that the teachings have been shared and understood. So here, this is from the original teachings of the Buddha, in his own words, helping you to understand that a Buddha is very rare in the world. So I'm going to open up to any and all questions that you guys might have related to what I've shared here today. This is everything that I have to share with you guys. You can ask your questions by putting those into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom, or you can raise your hand in Zoom and ask any questions that you like. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So I'll just end class by thanking you for understanding my voice. As you can tell, I'm a little bit sick. Got a bit of a sinus infection here, trying to work through that, taking some medicines that will help. And I appreciate you learning and practicing today, being dedicated to understanding the teachings of the Buddha. And at the same time, I would like to invite you to our future classes, because next Sunday, I'm going to be sharing the frequently asked questions section of this book. In the very back of this book, there's frequently asked questions. There's about 11 of them there that are commonly asked of me, and they didn't necessarily fit into anywhere else in the book. So I put them in the very back of the book, and this will further help you to understand the path to enlightenment by understanding these frequently asked questions. And then on Wednesday, I'm going to be doing a guided breathing mindfulness meditation session with you and opening up to any and all questions that you like. So you're welcome to tune in either at 9 a.m. Thai time on Sunday and Wednesday, or 9 p.m. Sunday and Wednesday, which is this group learning program. And we're going to be restarting from the very beginning on March 17th. And you might see some people coming in here towards the end of the group learning program to start kind of getting used to attending these sessions. But I'm going to be starting from the very beginning on March 17th. And it's really wise for people to come in towards the end like this and kind of get situated with learning the teachings, so that then on March 17th, which is a Sunday, when I restart that, people will be right there ready to start. So if you have friends or family that are interested in learning the teachings of the Buddha, they're more than welcome to register for this program by going to our website, BuddhaDailyWisdom.com, and under the online learning section, you'll see the first program is called the group learning program, and they can register at no cost to be able to attend either in person here in Chiang Mai at the temple, or you can attend online because I live stream all the classes, courses, and retreats that I share at the temple and then here at home as well. And then when you can't attend live, then you have the recordings either on the YouTube channel, the Facebook group, or on our podcast to be able to learn at your own pace on Monday or Tuesday or whenever you would like to learn. So thank you all for your questions. Thank you all for your dedication to learning and understanding the teachings. As you need help, feel free to reach out. I'm here to help you. You can ask questions in online classes. You can post them into the Facebook group. You can send me a private message, or you can schedule personal guidance and I'll be able to help you. So we'll potentially see you in one of these future classes. Have a very lovely and wonderful rest of your day. Take care. Sawadee ka.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To provide support for this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha. To access more teachings, visit buddhadailywisdom.com. There, you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Remember to establish a daily, consistent meditation practice, along with learning and practicing these teachings. A well-developed meditation practice is the foundation in which to train the mind to attain enlightenment.